This is an ABC podcast.
This Thursday, does the world need to brace itself for a pandemic as the coronavirus continues to spread? Originating in China, the virus is sweeping through other parts of Asia and is now taking hold across the Middle East and Europe. So with experts making dire predictions about our health system being overwhelmed and with the economy already being buffeted, is Australia ready?
Where the pressure point is in the hospital system with severely ill patients. And the main pressure point is really in intensive care units and the high dependency wards of hospitals. So they're the ones that are particularly difficult to manage because they're often full anyway.
That's coming up on The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Good afternoon. Well, it wasn't that long ago when we began to report about a virus in a Chinese city you don't often hear about. At first, it infected a small number of people in Wuhan. Now there have been 81,000 reported cases of COVID-19 worldwide and almost 3,000 related deaths. Most of the cases have been reported in China, but the virus has now spread to 33 countries. For the latest, I'm joined in the studio now by The World Today's Gavin Coote, who's been covering the coronavirus extensively. Gavin, good afternoon. The virus is now spreading into Europe. We're hearing about northern Italy at the moment. What do we know so far?
Well, Tom, the outbreak there is centred around the northern cities of Milan and Venice. In that country, more than 400 people have reported infections, and at this stage, the death toll is at 12. The World Health Organization is taking this outbreak very seriously, and overnight, the WHO's European Director, Hans Klug, spoke about it.
There is indeed no need for a panic and for trust by the people in what the government in Italy is doing. We are ready to scale up the capacity together to ensure that all regions in the country are equally prepared.
Now, Tom, the other region where the virus is now spreading is the Middle East, where Iran, it's reported more than 130 cases and at least 19 deaths in the past week. The country's also been the source of dozens of cases in neighbouring countries, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Kuwait, Oman and Pakistan.
So, Gavin, at the moment, Australia has been able to curb the spread of the coronavirus, but authorities are on alert. What are they telling us at this stage?
Well, Australia had already declared COVID-19 a disease of pandemic potential more than a month ago, but it's now published an emergency response plan for the virus. If it becomes a pandemic, big public events such as sporting matches could be cancelled. That could potentially affect the AFL and NRL seasons, and people could also be asked to work from home. The states also have their own pandemic plans at the ready, and for example, in New South Wales, stadiums could be used for mass quarantine. Police would be charged with guarding medical stockpiles, both national and state, and even schools could be closed. Another big concern is the upcoming Olympics. Earlier, we heard the International Olympic Committee senior member Dick Pound was saying if the virus isn't contained, the Tokyo Games could be cancelled. And today I actually went to an Olympic event here in Sydney where Australians, our sailing crew was announced. But coronavirus was very much on the front of their minds. Australia's chef de mission, Ian Chesterman, says preparations for the Olympics haven't changed, but they are keeping an eye on the situation.
Yeah, it's a huge operation, Olympic Games, and so nobody wants to cancel the Games, that's for sure. It's not something which has happened except once, I think, in the recent history of the Games, but which was due to a war. We really need to wait and see what happens over the next month or 2 months as things develop and evolve. You know, it's a decision that the IOC will make at the end of the day as to whether the Games are held or not.
Right, so Gavin, there were athletes at the event you went to this morning. How do they feel about it?
Yeah, I spoke with Jamie Ryan. She's a 49er class sailor. She competed at the Rio Olympics. Now, she's trying not to get too bogged down in speculation that the Olympics could be cancelled.
absolutely. We're not really worried about it at this stage. We're just focusing on what we've got to do and planning to be in Tokyo in a couple of months' time.
Because I guess you can't really even let that get in your head, can you? You've just got to push on.
Yeah, we just focus on what we can control at this stage.
Sailor Jamie Ryan, she was speaking there to Gavin Coote. Well, as we've just heard, there are fears that the Tokyo Olympics might have to be cancelled. So is the Japanese government up to handling the outbreak? Koichi Nakano is a political science professor at Sophia University in Tokyo. He spoke to our reporter, Eleni Soltis.
When the crisis unfolded in China, the Japanese government wasted at least 2 weeks and more by simply, you know, sort of watching and hoping that it doesn't come to Japan. And even after the first case of infection domestically was known, and also even after the first person deceased on a human-to-human transmission of the disease inside Japan, they basically were still sort of, you know, refusing to admit that the spread is happening inside Japan and didn't take even budgetary measures to boost the response. So I don't think, you know, you can say that there's not a man-made aspect to the disaster that is unfolding in the Japanese case.
So how confident are you Tokyo can safely host the Olympics?
I think it's really getting, you know, looking worse and worse at the moment. At this point, I think, you know, one thing that is all already for sure is that the Japanese government handling of the outbreak has really undermined the confidence of the foreign community in Japan in particular, in the Japanese government's ability. And that includes the foreign correspondents who cover Japan on a daily basis as well. So negative news in terms of, you know, not enough information provided to anybody, let alone in English or in other foreign languages, you know, the dubiousness about the statistics or, you know, alleged refusals of conducting tests even. These are things that the government needs to also, you know, come clear on.
Professor Nakano, do you see the Olympics going ahead?
At this point, if I had to bet, I think it looks really quite uncertain. They may still go ahead with an Olympics without any audience or whatever, but I think, you know, that would be not only humiliating for Japan, but also the economic consequences of no visitors to Japan is going to be tremendous. So I'm sure they're going to try to avoid that at all cost. But could they really do that? Because even if the spread starts to slow down or stop for Japan in the coming weeks, well, if it's going to continue to spread in other parts of the world, then again, in this instance, that will be beyond Japan's control.
Koichi Nakano from Sophia University in Tokyo, speaking there to Eleni Soltis. Well, it's not just Italy where we're hearing new reports of the virus today. Cases in three countries, Croatia, Brazil and Greece, have been linked to northern Italy. And while the World Health Organization is yet to label the coronavirus a pandemic, some experts think it's only a matter of time. Professor Dominic Dwyer is a medical virologist and the director of public health pathology at the New South Wales Health Pathology Service.
Look, declaration of a pandemic really revolves around the spread of a new disease in different countries or indeed different continents where the spread is unlinked to previous origin of the outbreak. It's that spread across countries that really makes the call for a pandemic.
Looking at the 2009 flu pandemic, how does it compare to this virus, COVID-19, in terms of the spread and the mortality rate?
To be honest, influenza is a bigger problem than the coronavirus here. However, what worries people most of all and gets a lot of the media attention is that people are scared of things that are new. The origin of this is still a little bit uncertain. The severity of this looked really bad in the beginning, but is probably not as bad as we first thought. The spread from animals into humans always has people worried. So I think it's those sorts of things that have driven a lot of the anxiety about it.
And when a virus like this spreads, there are always worst case modelling. We're hearing now that if there is sustained transmission in Australia, it may result in anywhere from 25 to 70% of the population getting infected. But what are the chances of that in your view? Because at the moment, the number of cases here is relatively small.
The number of cases in Australia is small. However, if the virus does cause a big outbreak in Australia, then the planning is around how do we manage that in terms of our hospitals and our schools and our public gatherings and all of those sorts of things. I think that we can't be entirely sure of how it's going to affect Australia, but I think we can be reassured that perhaps, unlike some of the other countries that are affected at the moment, our health systems are reasonably robust.
What can happen to this virus over time? Can it weaken or on the flip side, can it incubate and get more severe as it continues to spread?
So one of the questions that people are concerned about is, can this coronavirus mutate? Interestingly, this coronavirus doesn't really mutate as fast as some other viruses, but how viruses change when they enter the human population, for example, move from the bat or the animal population into humans, is a little bit unpredictable. But generally, the viruses mutate fairly slowly in the beginning, and there's nothing to suggest on the international databases that indeed in Australia we contribute to of viral sequences to show that there's any significant or worrying mutation.
Based on a worst case scenario, and as you say, a lot of modelling and preparedness, you know, that's in play all the time, is there a chance that sporting grounds and other community facilities could be used as makeshift hospitals if the virus spreads in Australia?
It depends a bit on how sick people are. I mean, we know with this coronavirus infection that the majority of people have a mild illness. Where the pressure point is in the hospital system with severely ill patients. And the main pressure point is really in intensive care units, because they're often full anyway with just the normal diseases that people get. So it's that pointy end of the health system that tends to be under the most stress rather than managing lots of otherwise mildly ill people.
Medical virologist Professor Dominic Dwyer. The coronavirus is continuing to damage the travel industry. Flight Centre has sharply downgraded its profit forecast, while Air New Zealand has become the latest airline to cut the number of flights. With the latest, here's the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
For Flight Centre, the global turbulence has been constant, with Brexit, US-China trade wars, unrest in Hong Kong, and now the coronavirus. Shares in the $3.5 billion company have fallen 20% so far this year. Founder and Chief Executive Graham Screw-Turner says customers are becoming more nervous.
There's some who are amending their bookings, extending their departure dates to later. It is fairly early days, but there's no doubt that February and March are going to be badly affected.
Flight Centre's half-year profit out this morning is down 74% to $22 million. And even though revenue is up, the company is factoring in what it calls a significant coronavirus impact, downgrading its full-year profit outlook by about $50 million. Graham Turner says it's not just the bread-and-butter consumers in the shopping mall, but big corporate clients changing or cancelling travel plans.
There's very few going to China. As you know, China's a really important trading partner, but I think some of the companies are using this chance to save costs, travelling less. But, you know, there's not wholesale panic or anything yet. Most people are still travelling to non-China destinations.
In your retail stores on high streets and in shopping malls, what sort of concerns are you seeing, and what are customers saying to you when they're wanting to review or change their travel plans?
Look, it's fairly natural. A lot of people book through a person because they can get good advice where to go and where it might be need to be cautious. So obviously, everyone's different and some people are more concerned than others, but generally most people are still going or maybe going later, but certainly there are some cancellations.
You're expecting this to take a bite out of your earnings, and this morning you've issued a profit downgrade, but how bad could this get if the coronavirus isn't contained within the next weeks or months?
That's a really difficult question, but there's no doubt that it looks like it's going to spread more, particularly outside China, but you know, it's It's just when it gets to the stage when people accept that this is going to be reasonably endemic, and governments try to contain it more within the their own regions or their own countries.
Major airlines have already cut capacity, and budget airlines are looking a bit shaky in terms of surviving this. So are we seeing the makings of a global economic shock?
It will depend on how long it goes, but certainly companies that are a bit weak with cash backup, you know, this will be a tough time probably.
Also today, Air New Zealand joined Qantas and Virgin in slashing flights as travellers change their plans or delay travel, reducing flights into Asia by 17%.
The ABC Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan. So, how's Australia placed when it comes to planning for the spread of the virus? Adam Camrad-Scott is an Associate Professor at the University of Sydney who specialises in global health security. He joined me earlier.
Australia's been very well prepared for a number of years with regards to national pandemic preparedness plans. So a lot of work was commenced around 2005, particularly with the emergence of H5N1 bird flu. And there's been a number of developments, including national exercises that Australia has run. And those plans have been constantly reviewed and updated since that time.
And you were involved in one of those national exercises. When was that?
So that was back in 2008, and it was called Exercise Sustain. What it did was look at the non-health sector impacts of a pandemic and how Australia would institute recovery plans to get the economy back on track.
Is that the last exercise of this type that we've seen in Australia?
That's the last national exercise that we've seen done, but obviously after that exercise occurred, we also had the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, and so those plans were revised in light of that experience, and the Australian Health Management Plan for Pandemic Influenza has been revised since then again as well.
And obviously health authorities are on alert in Australia at the moment as this virus spreads, but do you think that we are due for another national exercise like what we saw 12 years ago?
Well, it's always wise, and certainly the WHO has been encouraging countries to conduct regular national exercises. So is it time for Australia to look at doing this again? Yes, arguably yes, but probably obviously after this current outbreak is over.
And obviously we're in the middle of it all now. What arrangements are in place for coordinating Australia's health resources at the moment?
So the National Incident Room in the Department of Health in Canberra has been activated since January, and they've been closely monitoring the developments overseas and obviously advising the government and advising the chief health officers all around the states and territories, as well as feeding up into the chief medical officer. So there is a number of committee structures which meet regularly to review the information and ensure that Australia's plans are moving in a timely manner towards preparing the nation for the arrival of coronavirus cases.
So hypothetically speaking, for example, let's say we see a cluster of cases in one state. What happens? How does the nation respond?
Obviously, the first process is to try and identify all of the cases. So there'd be contact tracing, which is basically where health officials try and identify all the people that may have come into contact with the people who are infected. And then those people would probably be isolated and encouraged to stay away from potentially spreading it to other people. In the event that we start to see sort of more widespread local community transmission, then health authorities obviously will move more rapidly or more broadly, providing information to the local community about what to do to try and reduce the risk of infection.
Adam Camrad-Scott from the University of Sydney. This is The World Today, and we'll turn to some other news now, where a Senate inquiry into the so-called sports rort saga has raised further questions this morning, again putting pressure on the Morrison government. Officials from the Australian Sports Commission have fronted the parliamentary inquiry, and they've revealed a briefing for the program wasn't received until after Parliament was dissolved for last year's election. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
Defending its role in this whole scandal, the Australian Sports Commission says the guidelines were always clear. The final call on who received these grants sat with the Sports Minister. John Wiley is the Commission's chairman.
There are rules and guidelines for every particular program, and those were the rules and guidelines for this particular program.
The Auditor-General found the Community Sport Infrastructure Program often favoured politically important seats over other applications that Sport Australia had deemed more worthy. Sports Commission officials have fronted a parliamentary committee this morning, and under questioning from Labor's Katie Gallagher, Luke McCann from the Sports Commission revealed it didn't receive approval to roll out the final round of funding until 8:46 a.m. on the 11th of April last year. That's 17 minutes after the Governor-General had prorogued the Parliament.
When was the Parliament dissolved on that day? Are you aware of that?
No, Senator.
I'm of the understanding it's at 8:30 a.m. or about that time. So if you received it at 8:46 a.m, we're actually in caretaker at that point in time. Were you aware of that?
No, Senator, I wasn't aware of that.
The Morrison government has stressed that all projects receiving funding through this scheme were eligible at the time of their assessment. A big problem is, as the audit office has pointed out, around 40% of the projects were ineligible by the time the funding agreements were signed. In many cases, that was because the clubs had begun construction work before both parties signed on the dotted line. Today, Liberal Senator Eric Abetz grilled Mr. Wiley over those issues around eligibility.
When we advised members of their approval. We also made it clear applicants.
Applicant,
that they should not commence until signing the agreement. So that was explicit in our advice.
The Minister, however, was entitled to take other factors into account. And so if the Minister's office perchance became aware that some volunteers had levelled some ground in anticipation, fingers crossed, that they might get a grant, that of itself should not disqualify them.
Well, under the guidelines, that particular, how you've characterised it, would be considered, in our view, commencement of physical works.
The officials also detailed the rationale the then minister provided for approving funding for several late applications. That included two projects in which state governments had said they'd provide funding if the federal government also stumped up, while other applications faced issues such as lead poisoning in the soil or field drainage problems. Scott Morrison has downplayed his office's role in all these decisions, but yesterday it emerged more than 130 emails about this scheme were exchanged between the Prime Minister's office and the former sports minister's office over a period of about 6 months. Labor leader Anthony Albanese spoke on his way into Parliament this morning.
And the fact is the Prime Minister continues to mislead Parliament.
But the current sports minister, Richard Colbeck, says he's confident the inquiry will reveal new evidence that will test the Auditor-General's assumptions.
Alexandra Beach. Overseas, and dozens have been killed in the deadliest outbreak of religious-fuelled violence the Indian capital has seen in decades. The clashes first broke out on Sunday between protesters for and against a controversial citizenship law, which Muslims claim discriminates against them. Muslim families living in the affected areas are now leaving their homes, saying they no longer feel safe. South Asia correspondent James Oten reports.
After days of rioting, parts of northeastern Delhi have been left a smouldering wreck. Cars have been torched and businesses burned to the ground.
I was really sad to see all this. My friend had borrowed money and invested in this shop here. They now have nothing left. He won't be able to recover from this.
Protesters have been occupying several streets in Delhi since last year. They're campaigning against a law that gives priority citizenship to non-Muslims from certain neighbouring countries. The latest unrest was sparked when protesters tried to occupy new territory. They were met with violence. Since then, rival groups have been carrying out tit-for-tat attacks. Vision of Hindu mobs attacking homes and mosques has gone viral on social media. This Muslim man told me members of his family, who live in a Hindu-majority area, simply don't feel safe anymore. Just down the road, outside a service station that was set on fire, another man tells me it's outsiders causing the unrest.
Hindus and Muslims are both scared. We live together here and support each other. Together, we stopped outsiders from entering our local area. Locals are very scared now. They are only stepping outside of their homes to go to work.
India's Supreme Court has come down hard on police, accusing the force of failing to do enough to curb the violence and arrest the instigators. The police commissioner, Amulya Patnaik, says his officers are bringing the situation under control.
Senior officers are on rounds. Extra forces have been given. And a lot of confidence-building measures are being taken.
Several areas of Delhi have been placed under curfew and police have been given special powers to use firearms if necessary. But protesters continue to occupy the streets that they've held onto since last year. A Supreme Court hearing was meant to discuss how to peacefully resolve that matter, but the latest unrest has pushed that hearing back a month. This is James Oaten in New Delhi, reporting for The World Today.
And that's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening. Don't forget, you can find our stories on the website and you can also download our podcast. I'm Thomas Ariti. Thanks very much for your company. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell, and I'm from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. When three baboons escaped from a van at a Sydney hospital earlier this week, it was a sharp reminder that we still experiment with animals in quite a big way. Today, what animal testing in Australia looks like in 2020, and why it's kept so quiet. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.